You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled First Steps in Christian Religious Renewal, Preparing the Ground for the Christian Community. Lecture 1, given in Stuttgart on June 12, 1921. My dear friends, you wished to gather here to discuss things inwardly connected with your vocations. I assume that your wish proceeded from the recognition of the seriousness of the situation of our time, a seriousness that manifests above all when one seeks to work in contemporary cultural life from a religious viewpoint. And I assume, further, that this is not for you primarily a question of theology, but a question of religion. The true burning question of our time is undoubtedly not just theological. You might even think that with a little goodwill, some people could clearly grasp the theological question in a relatively short time. What everyone who looks at our time in an unbiased manner must understand, however, is not a question of dogma or theology. It is the question of the sermon and all that is connected to it. It is the question of the religious, that is, of the working of the religious element as such. And with the question of religion, we are asking a much broader, more comprehensive question than any theological question could ever be. If we begin from the outset, from a religious perspective, the task is one of regaining the possibility of making the spiritual worlds, with all their manifold effective forces, available once more to human beings. Available initially, at least, if we restrict ourselves to the religious, through the Word. In this context, we must already be conscious of the fact that a quite new evolutionary development here poses a very serious question. Anyone who believes that starting where older people among us still stand will have any other consequence in modern civilization than the actual and complete corruption of religious life does not see or fully grasp the question. Whoever believes he or she is able to rescue religious life by starting from the old conditions assumes an impossible position. I am not saying this as an introduction, because I want to start from some spiritual scientific dogma. I shall certainly not do that. What I am saying is simply what reveals itself to unbiased observation of life today. We must be aware of this when we speak of what must be spoken of in real, true Christianity, irrespective of whether our sermons resonate today in the hearts of our contemporaries. As for our days here, I expect they will be spent in question and answer, and in discussing what lies in your hearts, the things that are actually important to you. Today, however, as an introduction, I wish to outline some of what we have to consider. We must be clear that what has emerged in humanity during the last 3 or 4 centuries as scientific education has already created a wide circle of influence around it. Those who are older can still notice the difference between what existed in the 1870s or 1880s and what surrounds us today. In the 1870s and 1880s, one could still speak to a larger number of people about questions of spiritual life as these arose out of the traditions of the various confessions or denominations, as well as out of the different sects. One could still find hearts and souls in which such traditional talk found resonance. Basically, today, we face a different time. Certainly, there are still many people who have not absorbed much of what culture and education have recently brought into our civilization. One can still speak to them about such concepts as Christ, the effect of grace, salvation, and so on, without an immediate resistance asserting itself in their hearts. But this will not last much longer. A new kind of popular culture is spreading at breakneck speed through broad masses of the population, by means of newspapers and popular magazines, and above all, when all is said and done, through the education in our schools. Even if ideas specifically antithetical to religion are not expressed in this current educational situation, feelings flourish there that rebel against such concepts as Christ, salvation, grace, and so on. So we should not forget that the ideas that are taken up in contemporary education are being poured into forms which, in the widest circles, cause an inner resistance to grow against actual religious life. Therefore, we must seek a new starting point. We must not allow ourselves any illusions about this. You see, when people seriously take up the now widespread scientific view that describes the universe as having a mechanical origin, and that organic life developed out of some mechanical mass, and that the outer human physical body evolved out of some similarly mechanical agglomeration, and when the facts leading to such hypotheses are followed so that one constructs an imagination of the end of the world that corresponds to them, under such conditions, you see, Christianity cannot possibly thrive. That this is not generally noticed today indicates a lack of inner honesty in human beings. They simply allow the mechanical, physical, natural order, and Christianity to exist beside one another, one on one side, the other on the other. Then they attempt to prove theoretically that these two things can coexist. The only problem is that in this process, what asserts itself in every unbiased soul as a feeling is covered up. And even if the intellect tries to find all the possible harmonies between Christianity and modern science, ordinary human hearts and minds, Gemüt, will reject all these attempts at mediation. The result can only be that the hearts and minds of our fellow human beings have less and less of a place for religion. If we do not consider the religious question from this deeper point of view, we do not truly appreciate the seriousness of the situation in which we are today. We do not encounter the difficulties I have just mentioned only in theology. We encounter them mostly where they do not express themselves clearly, in the subconscious of our fellow human beings. We encounter them precisely when we wish to cultivate religion, not theology. This is what is important and must, above all, be understood. In this area, it is the Ritschl school of thought, with all its fringe theories, that is especially characteristic of what has happened recently. Ritschl is spelled R-I-T-S-C-H-L. The Ritschl school, as you most likely know, is held to be extraordinarily great by many of those who work in the field of religion. Yet what is the Ritschl school actually? It is the school of thought that takes the view that the last centuries, especially the 19th century, have yielded a great sum of scientific knowledge, and that this scientific knowledge is dangerous for religious life. It is clear to the Ritschl school that if we let scientific knowledge, whether as criticism or the development of dogma, into religious life, scientific knowledge will corrupt religious life. Therefore, they say, we must seek a different basis for religious life. We must start with faith. Yes, well, but with that, the soul is split into two, as it were. On the one side, we have the theoretical, cognitive forces of the soul that deal with science. And, on the other, we establish a part of the soul that develops out of itself capacities that are totally different from those of cognition. That is the sphere of faith. And now a battle is fought, not to build harmony between science and religion, but to exclude science from religion. The battle is for a sphere in which the soul can move without admitting scientific thinking at all. The ideal of those who belong to the ritual school is to allow as few scientific ideas as possible, if possible, absolutely none, to play into religious life. Now, irrespective of whether you can ascertain such a view theoretically, or convince yourself that such a division of the soul into two could exist, it is nevertheless true that for the actual life of the soul, many forces rebel against this two-part soul out of the subconscious, and that precisely because of that, religious life is undermined. But we can ignore all that. We need only to look at what is positive in the ritual theory, in order to see how, in the end, as far as religious feeling is concerned, it loses all content. Consider the most important forces that play a role in religious life. First, there is the sphere of faith. Whether it leads to knowledge or not, we will discuss later. Second, there is the sphere of actual religious experience. This also we will want to consider in greater detail later. Third, there is the sphere of religious authority. Since Luther, Protestant life has done extraordinarily much to correct and to explain the concept of authority. In its struggle against the Catholic Church, Protestant life aroused, one could say, a clean feeling with regard to the concept of authority. Without Protestantism, it is clear that one should not speak of an outer authority. Only Christ Jesus can be the authority for the individual soul. And yet at the very moment when, according to the viewpoint of the ritual school, one comes to the content of religious life, that is, to the second point, actual religious experience, one immediately encounters an immense difficulty, one that, as you know, confronts all the more recent followers of ritual in a profoundly meaningful way. Ritual himself does not want a nebulous, dark, mystical experience of faith. He wants to make the Gospels the sole content of religious life. And I have the word soul here as S-O-U-L, the soul content, not S-O-L-E, of religious life. A religious person should be able to experience the content of the Gospels. That is, in other words, one should also be able to use the content of the Gospels for one's sermons. Right away, however, Rachel's newer followers find themselves in a difficult situation. Take, for instance, the letters of Paul. In the letters of Paul, there is, naturally, quite a lot of Paul's own religious experience, which, from a certain point of view, is quite subjective. It is not simply religious experience for all people generally. One can only relate to it by saying, Paul had this experience, and put it into his letters. And I can only have a connection to it when I tell myself, I look to Paul. I attempt to find my way into his religious experience, and attain a relationship to it. But this is precisely what the newer Richlians want to exclude. They say that this kind of subjective religious experience cannot be the actual content of general Protestant belief, because it leads to simply acknowledging an outer authority, even if it is an historical authority. According to them, one should appeal only to what can be experienced in every individual human soul. From this point of view, Paul's letters would have to be omitted from the Gospels. Therefore, as far as contents for sermons are concerned, the letters of Paul would have to be left out. One would simply not be able to include the letters of Paul in the content of the general sermon. Now, if you consider the matter impartially, you will hardly doubt that what the ritual school today counts as objective experiences can also count to unbiased examination, only as a subjective experience. For example, the presentation of the life of Christ Jesus as it is told in the Gospels, can be relived by everyone, but not, for instance, the teaching of his taking on behalf of humanity, the sins of the world, and attaining their remission. You would have to accept for the general sermon what refers to the experiences of Christ Jesus, but not, however, what has to do with the taking on and the attaining of forgiveness of sins on our behalf, or anything connected with that. In fact, considering the matter impartially, you will find that you can hardly say that there is, with regard to Christ Jesus, any such a kernel of general experience on which you can call for the general sermon. If they were only impartial and open enough, in the end the Richelieans would find it necessary to let piece after piece fall away, until finally there was basically very little left of the content of the Gospels. However, if the content of the Gospels is left out completely as content for the sermon, even for religious instruction, then no concrete content remains that can be shaped. The only thing that remains is what would be designated as a general, nebulous, mystical God experience. We meet this more and more among individuals today who believe that they can nevertheless be good Christians. We encounter the fact more and more that every content that can be shaped, and even when it comes from the depths of the human being, a content must lead to a certain formulation, that every such content is rejected, and actually only a particular direction of feeling toward a universal divine element is looked to. Indeed, in many cases, honest religious Christian striving today is in many ways already on the way toward becoming such a blurred feeling content. Here, especially, Protestantism has reached an extremely significant turning point, one indeed where there is the greatest danger that it could get into an extraordinarily bad position in relation to Catholic teaching. You see, Catholic teaching never set much store in the content of the Gospels. Catholic teaching has always worked, including in the sermon, with symbolism. You will notice, even today, how strongly symbolism comes to life again among Catholic priests, who are equal to their task as preachers, even more so where Catholicism strives for regeneration. You will notice how dogmatic content, certain contents with facts and beings of the supersensible life, are clothed in symbols, as it were. There is full consciousness, even among the relatively lower clerics, that symbols live extraordinarily deeply into the soul, much more deeply than dogmatic or doctrinal content. They are aware that they can contribute to the spreading of religious life much more when truths of salvation are expressed in symbolic form, when these truths are given a completely pictorial nature, and no actual doctrinal content is let in. You know, too, that in the Catholic Mass, the Gospel is only read. The sermon in the Catholic Church avoids introducing the contents of the Gospels as an object of teaching for its believers. Whoever can assess what power lies in a new development of the symbolic content of the sermon will already understand that today, in fact, we are at an important turning point where the main results of Protestant life during the last centuries could face an intense quandary, an extraordinarily difficult situation in relation to the expanding powers of Catholicism. When you see, besides this, how, on the one hand, Protestant life itself is losing its connection with the content of the Gospels, and how, on the other hand, a kind of nebulous mysticism is all that remains as its content, then you can also say that the power of faith itself stands on very shaky ground. One must be clear about this. The power of faith today stands on very shaky ground. In addition, you cannot avoid having to say, no matter how great the barriers you erect to keep scientific ideas from penetrating into religious life, scientific ideas which produce only irreligious life, not religious life, will in the end still tear down those barriers. All that the modern way of scientific thinking, as it is officially practiced today, can accomplish, you might not accept it at first, but after studying the matter historically, you will have to acknowledge it, is that, in the end, there will be books like David Friedrich Strauss's titled Alter und Neuer Glaube, Old and New Belief. Of course, the book is trite and superficial, but such triteness and superficiality is the necessary consequence if one really takes seriously the scientific ideas that are considered valid today and wants to form any kind of religious or faith content. Now, as I have already suggested, what we need in the religious sphere are such concepts as Christ, grace, salvation, and so on. Yet, how can the unique effect of the mystery of Golgotha be possible in a world that has evolved in the way natural science views it? How can you place a unique Christ in such a world? You can present an exceptional human being, but you will see when you try to describe this person's life that you cannot remain honest without facing the question, how does the life of this most excellent person differ from that of a Plato, a Socrates, or any other excellent human being? You will not be able to come to terms with this question. If you are unable to see any other processes in earthly human evolution than those that science, when it is honest, can accept today, then you will also be unable to place the mystery of Golgotha somehow into history. We have all experienced the significance of, quote, ignorabimus, close quote, which means we will not know, Ranke in relation to the question of Christ. Let me read that again. We have all experienced the significance of ignorabimus, Ranke, in relation to the question of Christ. It seems to me that the ignorabimus, Ranke, should play a more important role for us than all the attempts by Ritschl's followers or others to capture a special sphere for the religious life where Christ can be valid and effective, because one sets up barriers against scientific life. Aside, I am not sure why he uses the word ignorabimus, and then right after it is the word Ranke, R-A-N-K-E, which is capitalized. It might be a person. I'm not clear. End of aside. You see, in these introductory words, I want to address our central question directly. I want you to contemplate the question, how can we speak in a world which runs according to the laws that science must accept today in such a way that somehow ethical impulses can be realized? Where should ethical impulses take hold when we have a universal causality in nature? At most, we can assume that in the beginning an ethical element did once intervene in the causal world of mechanical nature and gave rise, to a certain extent, to the general mechanical tendency that now continues automatically. But if we are honest, we must admit that we cannot imagine a mechanical nature of this kind as permeated by any ethical impulses. We also cannot imagine, if we accept universal mechanicity and the universal mechanical causality of nature, that our own ethical impulses can affect anything in the world of natural causality. People today are just not honest enough. If they were, they would say to themselves, if we accept the universality of natural causality, then our ethical impulses are certainly beautiful human impulses, but such beautiful human impulses remain, nevertheless, just illusions. We can say that we have ethical ideals living within us. We can even say that the radiance of a divinity, whom we revere and adore, shines upon these ethical ideas. But to ascribe a definite reality to this divinity, and even to ascribe any connection between our prayer and the divinity and its will, remains an illusion. Certainly one must acknowledge the industriousness and goodwill that has been brought to bear from the most varied sides, in order, on the one hand, to be able to stand on the side of natural causality, and, on the other hand, to reserve a special sphere for religious life. We must recognize this. But there is, nevertheless, a kind of inner dishonesty in doing so. If we are to be inwardly honest, we cannot allow this split to exist. Now, most probably, as our deliberations continue here, we will not need to occupy ourselves too much with the results of spiritual scientific investigations. We will receive the content for our religious questions, as it were, out of the purely human element. Yet, to draw your attention to the central point, I want to make you conscious of the fact that spiritual science, with its absolutely real results that are just as valid as the results of natural science, cannot base itself on universal natural causality. Let us understand one another correctly, precisely on this point, my dear friends. You see, the latest thing the study of nature has brought is the law of the conservation of matter and energy. You know that this law of the conservation of energy has intervened in a devastating way in psychology. We cannot come to terms with soul life and its freedom if we take this law of conservation of matter and energy seriously. And the foundations that science today gives us for the understanding of the human being are such that we can have no option but to think that this law apparently also applies to the whole human being. You know that spiritual science, not as a preconceived dogma, but as the result of spiritual research, has insight into repeated earth lives. In the light of such insight, between birth and death we live, on the one hand, with impulses deriving from heredity, we will come back to this, and on the other with impulses belonging to earlier lives, and to life between death and rebirth. Now, the world we live in between death and a new birth encompasses facts that are not subject to the law of conservation of matter and energy. When we seek, as it were, the spiritual connection between our present life and our next one, and going beyond that to lives that do not occur in a physical body, but take place spiritually after the end of the earth's existence, then we encounter cosmic contents that are not subject to our laws of nature, and consequently also not subject to the law of conservation of matter and energy. What is the connection between what plays into a later life from out of an earlier one, and what a person then does in his or her deeds under the influence of earlier earthly lives? This connection cannot be grasped by natural laws, even if they extend right into the most inward structure of the human being. Every predisposition that works into this life from previous ones is such that its lawfulness has nothing to do with universal natural laws. This means, if we have moral impulses in this life, we can say, in the end, these ethical impulses cannot complete themselves in the physical world. They can, however, live over from the present life into the next, because in between we pass through a sphere exempt from natural lawfulness. By thinking in this way, we reach an admittedly transformed but nevertheless thoroughly graspable cognitive concept of wonder. Then the concept of wonder takes on meaning again. Wonder can only mean that not just natural laws have consequences, but that ethical impulses also have their consequences. True, if we are totally absorbed in natural causality, our ethical impulses do not flow into the natural order. However, if we are lifted out of natural causality, if we put time, so to speak, between cause and effect, the concept of wonder receives a completely cognitive content again. Indeed, in a still deeper sense, it then receives content. If, from the spiritual, scientific standpoint, we look, for example, at the origin of the earth, we do not see the forces that work today in universal nature at work in the origins of the earth. What we see is that the laws of nature are excluded from the metamorphosis of the preceding earth condition into the present earth condition. And when we reach the end of the earth's existence, when, as it were, the Clausius formula is fulfilled and entropy has intensified to its maximum and the heat death of the earth has begun, then the same thing enters in again. That is, we see, both at the beginning and at the end of the earth, natural causality excluded, and another form of activity at work. It is precisely at such times, when natural lawfulness is excluded, such as lie for us between death and a new birth, and which lies for the earth itself, before and after its present stage of metamorphosis, that the possibility of intervention by ethical impulses exists. Humanity has already, one might say, taken the first of two necessary steps. The first step is that all rational people, and also all religious people, have given up the old superstitious idea of magic that presupposes that we can intervene in the effects of nature through this or other or that machination. Today, instead of the magical view, we have the view that we must simply let nature run its course, that we cannot master natural causality by means of spiritual forces. We say that natural causality must run its course, and we have no influence on it. For this reason, magic, in the old superstitious sense, is excluded from our spheres of knowledge. However, as correct as this is for certain periods of time, it is just as incorrect when we consider greater periods of time. For example, from the point of view of spiritual scientific cognition, if we look at the time period that lies, for us, between death and a new birth, then we see that we pass through a region that appears somewhat as follows. Imagine for a moment that when we die at the end of our present life, we first leave the world in which we perceived universal natural causality with our senses and intellect. This universal natural causality continues to reign on the earth that we have now abandoned through death. And at first, following death, when we look from the other side to life on this side, we cannot say anything other than that effects grow out of the causes that were active during our life. Out of these effects, then, further causes arise, and out of these causes again new effects arise. Thus, after death, we see natural causality continue, persist. If we have led a fairly normal soul life, life continues after death until all impulses active during earthly life have reached their conclusion in the working sphere of earth itself, and a new spiritual impetus enters in, that is, until the last causalities cease and a new element is present. Only when the Spirit provides a new impetus, so that the previous stream of causality ceases, do we reincarnate. We descend to a new life, not because we rediscover the effects of causes from our previous life. We do not find them. But we find a new rhythmic phase, a new rhythm, a new element or impulse. We have, as it were, spiritually crossed over a nodal point of rhythmic development. We cannot say in one life that causes that were present in a previous life are working themselves out. Rather, for our human life, they have all reached a nodal point where they have exhausted themselves. This does not, of course, as yet include the effects of the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms, which will be exhausted only at the end of the period of the earth stage of metamorphosis. But everything of an ethical nature that has to do with us human beings has entered a zero point, and a new beginning is needed. We take the impulses for this new beginning with us out of the spiritual life we pass through between death and a new birth, and we do so in order thereby to be able to connect ourselves with the impulses that form the earth out of the ethical divine. We can connect with them when we ourselves are in that world out of which the new impulses flow. So, we must say, if we look at our life between birth and death, certainly no superstitious magic is present. But the connection with the next life nevertheless comes about in such a way that we can actually speak of magic. However, it is impossible to speak of a direct influence of the spiritual into the physical. The important thing is that we learn through spiritual science that there is not simply a connected, constant stream of causality from beginning to end. There are causality rhythms that pass through certain time periods that are not so terribly long in comparison with the whole development of the earth. These causality rhythms come to a null point, a zero point, then a new causality rhythm enters in. When we enter into a new causality rhythm, we do not find the effects of the previous causality rhythm. On the contrary, we must bring them over into our soul through those after effects that we must carry over into our present earthly lives because of karma. With this, I wanted only to indicate that in reality, spiritual science has no need to accept anything from those who want to regenerate religion today. To do so would mean, for many, accepting a new dogmatism. I only wanted to point out that, without harming the apparently necessary validity of the laws of nature, spiritual science can give the science of the outer world a form or paradigm that human beings can fit into again, so that they can again really call their ethical impulses world impulses, and will not be forced back into mere powerless beliefs. You must at least take this into your consciousness as a possibility. Without this possibility, in your own consciousness, you will not be understood by those to whom you must deliver a sermon. I would also like to present something to you that I have often used for the teachers in the Waldorf School. It forms an important pedagogical principle. You see, if we want to teach children that something is valid, we should not expect that children will understand this validity if we do not believe it ourselves, that is, if we ourselves are not convinced of it. I usually give as an example the fact that it is good to use a symbol to teach children about the immortality of the soul. We tell the children about the butterfly that crawls out of the chrysalis and make the comparison that just as the butterfly lives in the chrysalis, so also our soul lives in us. It is just that we cannot see it. This soul then flies away when death comes. Two things can happen when we do this. For one thing, we can fancy ourselves to be very clever, and can think that, though this symbol says nothing about immortality, quote, I will use it for the children anyway, because they are ignorant of the facts, and in this way I can make them understand it, close quote. If we are objective enough, however, we will soon realize that our feeling of superiority over the childish view cannot lead to fruitful instruction. What we are not convinced of ourselves will not convince the children. This is how imponderables work. My instruction bears fruit for the children only when I can believe that my symbol corresponds in every detail and every word to reality. Spiritual science, of course, provides reasons for this, because for spiritual science the butterfly that crawls out of the chrysalis is not a made-up imaginary symbol. for spiritual science, it is actually true that the same thing that appears as a butterfly on a lower stage manifests on a higher stage as immortality. The cosmic powers themselves have ordained that the transition of the soul into immortality should manifest in the image of the butterfly crawling out of the chrysalis. Thus, if we look upon the image as a reality, our instruction will bear fruit. It will not, however, bear fruit if we think ourselves to be a clever person who fashioned this image himself or herself. It will be successful when we know that the cosmos itself gives us this image. This is how imponderable forces work between the soul of the teacher and the souls of the children. And the same is true in religious instruction, in the sermon. We must carry in our own souls the foundations, all the fundamentals, of whatever it is we want our listeners to understand. And we must never have any concepts in our minds that contradict the matter at hand. Let me put it this way. Assume that you are like the modern followers of ritual, or others who are complete believers in the immortality of the soul, in the existence of God, and so on, but at the same time are weak enough to accept the Kant-Laplace theory, and indeed do so in the way that modern science teaches it. The fact that the Kant-Laplace theory sits in your mind and soul and objectively contradicts the content of your Christian creed, or the belief that you have to represent immediately adversely affects the power of conviction that you must have in order to give an effective sermon. Try to read that again. The fact that the Kant-Laplace theory sits in your mind and soul and objectively contradicts the content of your Christian creed, or the belief that you have to represent immediately adversely affects the power of conviction that you must have in order to give an effective sermon. Even when you do not know that a contradiction is there, the contradiction works and has an effect. This means that those who want to preach a sermon must bear within themselves all the elements that make their worldview consistent, that is, without contradiction. Certainly theology will not help much with the sermon, yet we must have it within us as something non-contradictable, and not as something that exists merely beside the science of the outer world. Theology must be able to encompass science, that is, it must be able to conduct itself in relation to it with complete understanding. We can also look at the matter from another side. You see, philosophy and science speak today of the most varied relationships of human beings to the world around them. However, you hardly ever find what philosophy and science speak of among ordinary and uncultivated people, even urban people, who listen to our talks and sermons today. Take, for example, the relationships that our psychologists propose between the human beings who observe nature and the human beings themselves. These relationships are not at all real. They are artificially created. What lives in the simplest farmers and in the most uneducated people of our world is that they seek deep within themselves, I say seek, deep within themselves for something that is not outside in nature. They search for something other than what they can find in nature, and you must speak to them about this if the feeling they have as religious feeling is to rise up. Simple, uneducated human beings express it as it lives in their subconscious. Quote, I am not made of this stuff out of which the world is made, and which I perceive with my senses. Tell me something about what I cannot perceive with my senses. Close quote. Such is the direct appeal that is directed to us if human beings are to make us their religious guide. We must tell them something about the real content of the supersensible world. All our theories of knowledge that say that sense perceptions and sense feelings are subjective or more or less objective, and so on, matter very little to the great majority of people. People want to learn from us that something lives in the world, which by its nature does not belong to the sense world. Here it really comes down to the question, how do we meet this human need? We can do so only if we find the right path from doctrine to ritual. I will give an introduction to this tomorrow. Today, I would like to hear what you have to say. I want to hear what your needs are. Perhaps we will begin to formulate questions rather than produce answers. Certainly, it would be quite good if we were to formulate the main questions. For my part, while I am here with you, I would prefer to give you what can help you to exercise the religious element, but not the theological element, in your vocation as religious leaders. Thus we will aim at the practice of religion, at the establishment of the religious aspect, and not so much at the theological questions. However, if you have theological questions that weigh upon you, we can also discuss those. Today I would ask that we at least formulate such questions as are of special concern for you. Parenthesis, a participant recommends that Mr. Bach from Berlin should formulate the questions. Close parenthesis. Emil Bach. Yesterday evening, I gave an account of the concerns that we tried to clarify in inner preparation for this course in Berlin, and how we tried to differentiate various categories of questions there. In connection with what we have now heard, we can indeed now formulate one question that integrates three of the areas around which we had questions, namely ritual or cultus, the sermon, and the question about the justification of the social element in the community or congregation. Yesterday evening, I tried to elucidate this with reference to church history. We actually found that for us, it is a matter of clarifying the relationship between the anthroposophical work of illuminating religious questions and purely religious practice. Thus, it is a question either of the relationship in the liturgy between the ritual and the sermon, or, encompassing this, what happens outside the ritual or cultus? That is, what is the relation of the religious service as a whole to the religious lecture activity, or the relation of the ritual to the religious instruction for children? After all, whatever human beings have not yet brought to conscious awareness is achieved by symbolism. For us, then, the question is, to what degree must this become conscious at all? And if it must come to consciousness, how is it to be done, and a balance wrought between the effect of symbols on that part of the human being which takes in the impulse itself, and on that part which simultaneously tries to attain consciousness concerning it? If we bear in mind the different natures of those before whom we will stand in the future, this again brings up several problems. Many of those in the congregation may not feel the need to bring religious impulses to consciousness, while many others will immediately and absolutely experience the need to become conscious of them. Connected with this is another question. How can we actually reconcile the striving for religious life in community with the striving for an enlivening of the I capital? We have to take into account many people belonging to the middle class, for whom, as far as we can see, it will be a question of developing a proper independence of the individual, a connection to the I forces, through religious practice. Yet, with many others, we will have the task of regulating the striving of the I that has lost its way. This is what we found we experienced around the question of communal or communitarian forces, insofar as we were able to gain some clarity for ourselves concerning brotherhood communities, brethren in the history of the Church. This is one group of questions that was important to us yesterday evening. We have three other areas of questions. The first is purely organizational. if we focus on developing ourselves, to be able to do this work, and assume the consequences that will ensue from this work into our own personal sphere of work, and if we find that it is in the end a matter of founding communities on the basis of a new principle, then the following questions arise. What preparatory work must we do? It is clear that the practicalities will be different according to the situation of each of us. Can we achieve this groundwork by giving lectures? How can we divide the work among us in a practical manner? And how can we arrange to do some of it together? Naturally, we do not expect the work to be made easy for us. We do not expect simply to receive a position. We are quite prepared to create the field of work. Yet, perhaps there are things to learn so that our work would be easier in a certain sense. In fact, there is a great deal that we would like to ask in the course of our discussions that is perhaps purely organizational. The second area of questions, in addition to the organizational, has to do with our relationship to theological knowledge. There were, above all, two questions in this sphere. The first question has to do with the previous theological training of a person who will later work in such new communities, insofar as the training is connected with the university, and we can learn from it. The second is a question of the new understanding of the Bible that presumes a theological background, and as technical training, goes, in a way, beyond a knowledge of the anthroposophical worldview. There are also those among us who perhaps have a few practical questions. One or two of us are perhaps inclined toward a scientific occupation. It would be interesting for us all to see how this theological, scientific work can still perhaps be made fruitful for contemporary religious life. The last of our six areas of questions is one that lends itself least to the formulation of a question. It is the question of the priestly qualities that we must expect of ourselves if we undertake this work. There is also a practical element closely related to this, about which we should ask. This would be the question of the selection of the people who should take up this work. We need to know how we should make the selection, quite apart from the fact that in the end the decision will lie with self-judgment. With this, I believe I have more or less covered what was said yesterday evening. Rudolf Steiner. These are certainly the questions that must be asked at the turning point I have already mentioned. Our time together will be spent becoming clear about precisely these questions and with some things that form the preliminaries to them. For the moment now that we have formulated the questions and before we discuss them, I would only like to point out that we live today in a time when just such questions must be assessed from the highest point of view, including the highest historical point of view. It is absolutely not the habit of spiritual scientists always to use the cliché, we live in a time of transition. Of course, every period of time is a time of transition from what existed earlier to what exists later. What is required of us is to look beyond what we consider to be a time of transition and look at what it is that is in transition. Something in our time is very powerfully in transition, and this is human consciousness itself, which is changing enormously. We are easily mistaken if we believe that consciousness as it is today is unchangeable. It is very easy to tell that there are people who, because of their higher education, wish to become conscious of the content of the ritual. Other people, conversely, feel no need to bring the matter to consciousness, and so do not strive to do so. You see, we live at the point in the evolution of humanity when it is characteristic that the number of people who want to have the ritual explained in a proper form is rapidly increasing, and we must take this into account. We may not develop the dogmatic prejudgment that believes you can explain it to one person but not to another. Whenever we presume that people, at a certain level of education, do not want to be enlightened about something, we will usually be wrong. The number of people who want to achieve a certain degree of consciousness about the symbolism and about what is living in the ritual is growing every day. The main question is a totally different one. It is, how do we develop a ritual and a symbolic content if, at the same time, when people inform themselves consciously about the symbolic content, we do not want this content to become abstract or foreign to people's feelings? How do we maintain the full value and validity of a ritual and its symbolic content? This is the question that is especially interesting for us today. One can, the example does not need to be precisely about the religious, point to Goethe's title Fairy Tale of the Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily, which came from a man of whom one can say, if one wishes to stress concepts, that he always dreamed such things. It is said that Schiller interpreted Goethe's dreams. In a certain way, Goethe was much more conscious of what lived in his fairy tale than Schiller was. The nature of Goethe's consciousness was such that it could live within the images themselves. It was not the abstract consciousness that is experienced today as the only consciousness. Today people confuse the intellect with consciousness. They believe that what is thought pictorially is not as conscious as what is thought with the intellect. They confuse intellectual thinking with consciousness. We will need to discuss the consciousness, unconsciousness, and superconsciousness of ritual and symbolism. This should certainly occupy us in the deepest way at the present time, because on the one hand there is the Catholic Church with its very powerful ritual and its extraordinarily powerful, goal-oriented symbolism. What immense power lies in the Mass when it is celebrated the way it is in the Catholic Church? That is, when it is celebrated with consciousness on the part of the faithful who are present. Also, the content of the Catholic priest's sermon is filled with symbolism and is permeated with will. On the other hand, we have the development of Protestantism over the last few centuries that has led away from ritual to the actual teaching of content, of doctrine. Doctrine has the tendency to work more deeply only when it is directed to the comprehension of the listeners or readers. For this reason, the Protestant churches face the danger of atomizing, of fragmenting. They face the danger that everyone can build their own individual church within their own hearts. Precisely because of this, it is impossible to form a community. This is one danger that must be met. We must have the possibility of forming community, a community that is not based on outer arrangements or organizations, but is built on inner soul nature. This means we must build a bridge between the kind of ritual that can endure in the face of modern consciousness and what leads over into deepened doctrinal teaching content, as the Protestant creed does. Doctrinal content individualizes. It analyzes or separates out the parts of the community until one finally reaches the individual human being. The content of what is taught separates individual human beings according to their tendencies. Psychologists can see the conflicted natures of present-day human beings who are individualized, separated right into and within their own individualities. Today we actually see human beings who strive to have not only their own individual creeds, but who have two or more creeds. These creeds then struggle with each other within their own souls. The countless conflicted natures of the present time are but the continuation of the tendency that individualizes, analyzes, and divides the community. The ritual, the symbol, is the synthesizing element that reunites what is separated. You can see this everywhere if you enter into it in a practical way. Therefore, this is the real question that lies at the basis of the community movement. The question of anthroposophical teaching, or the anthroposophical explanation of things, and purely religious practice, must be answered in a new way, out of our own important time and movement. We are experiencing something tragic today, and it would be significant if a force would emerge from your community here that could lead humanity away from this tragedy. When, in addition to traditional, historical, and scientific education, you have what comes out of the whole of anthroposophy as religious education, you can make an observation. When you examine the religious teachings that emerge out of anthroposophy, the ideas that you attain, and as a consequence, the feelings that come about, are such that they can lead only to a yearning to transform themselves into outer symbols, into images. These anthroposophical ideas are often misjudged as being of the same nature as other ideas. Our usual ideas, whether from science or from social life, merely provide information, and in this sense criticize and undermine everything. Anthroposophical ideas lead to a certain kind of devotion in the human being, to a certain kind of love. Just as our red blood can do nothing other than build us up, so anthroposophical ideas can do nothing other than arouse our human feeling and will natures, so that they feel the deepest yearning to express these ideas in symbols, in images. The images in my title Outline of Esoteric Science are not merely artificially thought-out pictures. What it comes down to, in the end, is that we express ourselves pictorially, that is, in images. In Dornach, in the center of the Goetheanum building, those who were there saw it, and naturally those who come later will see it finished. There is a sculpture, a Christ group. Christ is shown with Lucifer and Ahriman, both of whom are defeated by Christ. In the figure of Christ, a synthesis of all that is sense-perceptible and suprasensible is presented before the eyes of all human beings. You see, one does not sculpt such a figure as this because we decided to place a statue there to decorate the place. Such is absolutely not the case. Rather, when we form concepts out of anthroposophy, eventually we have to come to an end with concepts. Just as when we come to a pond and cannot go any farther or make progress, we swim. We come to a point where we can no longer form abstract concepts or ideas, but must proceed in images. The ideas themselves demand that we begin to express ourselves in pictures. I have often told my audiences the following. There are certain theories of knowledge, especially among the Protestant theologians, which state that what we know must be clothed in purely logical forms, that we must look at things only with logic. Otherwise, what we have is only myth. Especially such people as Brun speak in this way. Brun agitated greatly against anthroposophy, claiming that it builds myths, is creating a new mythology. But what happens when we challenge this charge with a counter-question? For instance, we can say, try just once to fathom the universe with your logic, without using images. If the universe itself works not only logically but also artistically, then you too must also look at it artistically. When the universe evades your logical contemplation, then what? Furthermore, the human form, similarly, escapes merely logical rumination. In other words, if you truly take up anthroposophical concepts, you will come to images, because nature does not work and create only according to the laws of nature, but also according to forms. Thus, we can say that anthroposophy, developed in a living way today, takes into consideration the need that exists in the hearts of our contemporaries to get beyond intellectualism. Actually, every rational contemporary person, participating consciously in evolution, admits this. They understand that we must get away from intellectualism. Naturally, this is also the case in theology. However, most people do not yet understand that to pass from concept to image, which then becomes ritual in the sphere of religious practice, is just as justified and original as the logical element. Most people imagine that we form pictures or images because we already have the concepts, and we then clothe these concepts in symbols. To do so is to produce only straw symbols. Such is not the case in Dornach. In Dornach, no symbol is based on a concept. Rather, at a certain stage, we move away from the idea, and then the image or picture is there as something original. It is there as image. One cannot say that one has led a concept over into the image. That would be straw symbolism. This striving to overcome intellectualism exists today. On the one hand, this is a striving for a soul life, which, because of objectivity, passes over into what is image-like. On the other hand, there is no belief in the picture or image today. This becomes tragic. People believe that if they are intelligent, they have to overcome the picture or image. They believe that they are conscious only when they have overcome the image. Such images as are found in Goethe's fairy tale of the green snake and beautiful lily are always stripped of their reality when someone attempts to explain or interpret them intellectually. This is the difference between my interpretation of Goethe's fairy tale and what other commentators do. They make annotations and explain the pictures intellectually. Intellectual explanations are just as foreign to the real imagination as, for instance, the German language is to Chinese. If I want to say something about the Chinese language in German, if I want to bring something Chinese to someone in German, I must lead them out of what is not Chinese so that they grasp what is Chinese as a whole and pass over into it. In exactly the same way, must we prepare ourselves for what is of a truly imaginal nature. We must proceed so that the relevant images can arise, and no explanation has to be added. It is tragic that the deepest need for the image exists, but that belief in the image has actually died out. We do not believe that an image contains anything that cannot be explained in intellectual concepts. This must be understood first, if we are now to discuss the topic of the symbol and consciousness. We can actually successfully answer the question of a balance between subconsciousness and consciousness, which torments so many people today, only if we are clear about the need for the image and the lack of belief in the image's reality. I would like for you to consider from now until tomorrow what I have said about the relationship of the intellectual concepts to true images or pictures. From this viewpoint, we will find that we can enter into the forming of community, because community building depends a great deal on the possibility of a ritual. Even the practical success of community building actually relies on the possibility of a ritual. Those who have gotten to know India and Indian religions rightly raise one point. In India, there are, naturally, very many sects. These sects have a quite strong community life that works deeply into the soul. It also exhibits itself as a practical community life and can include a great deal, from the perspective, of course, of the version appropriate to the East, that lies at the basis of brotherhood communities. This is, in many cases, based on the fact that the people in the East do not know what we call subjective personal conviction in relation to their surrounding community. People in the East, when they participate in spiritual life at all, do not understand that one cannot have one's own opinion, for example, about a community or a doctrine. They absolutely do not understand this. As regards the concept, everyone can have his or her own opinion or thought. What one has in common with others is only the picture or image. The people of the East are aware only that the picture is the communal element. It is peculiar to the West that we have the tendency to value conviction on being convinced, and that because of this an atomizing or fragmentation occurs. When we seek to be convinced, seek conviction, we come to atomization. This does not arise in community with others when we seek something other than conviction. Conviction must be able to be completely individual. We must raise the issue that on the one hand the I, capital, is there as the culmination of the individual life, and on the other, Christ is the power and the being who unites himself with the innermost being, not just of Christians. Christ as power and being must be expected to unite with all human beings. We must attain the possibility of a bridge between the totally individual I, which wants to believe what it can, and community with Christ. We should occupy ourselves quite intensively with the question of community building, and as Mr. Bach so rightly said, of the groundwork for it, as there are, naturally, things that will present quite other difficulties. First of all, we rely today almost completely on doing the preparatory work through instruction or teaching, so that we can find enough people who can develop an understanding for what is actually intended. Yet we face a totally splintered humanity. The simple fact that we present ourselves with the pretension to know something about something, which another perhaps would need a day to consider before making a judgment, is already almost enough for us to be immediately reprimanded. What works and weaves between human beings is extraordinarily difficult today. And this, of course, makes community building difficult. Nevertheless, if you want to achieve something with the only thing you can be striving for by coming here, we will need to discuss most thoroughly the issue of building community. Above all, we need to consider the necessary preparatory work, which will have to consist essentially of our feeling ourselves to be spiritually community builders. What I will now say might not be immediately understandable, as it touches on one of the deepest issues of the present. The only way we can become community builders is first of all to attempt to dispense with teaching other people. People simply do not allow themselves to be taught today. This should not be our main task. As small as the success of the anthroposophical work I had to take on as my task is, this success does exist to a certain extent, even though in small circles. It is there. And this success exists because, in the first place, as this work is taken up in our cultural centers, I have actually never wanted to teach anyone against their will. I have actually always acted according to a law of nature. I always told myself, the herring lays an infinite number of eggs in the sea. Very few of these eggs become herrings. A certain selection must take place. Those who know that whatever goes beyond the material continues to work further know, too, that even the unfertilized herring eggs serve a purpose in the world as a whole. They have a great effect in the etheric world, while the selection of the eggs, which are to become herrings, takes place on the physical plane. People who know this have no problem with the question, why are some herring eggs not fertilized? What is not fertilized has its great task in another world. Unfertilized eggs are not completely without significance, and it is basically the same in the case of teaching, too. When I have spoken to an audience of 50 or of 500 people, I have spoken to even larger groups, I have never believed that I could teach half or even a quarter of them. Rather, I assume that with what I have to say I would reach, on the first try, out of 500 people, perhaps 5, who are predestined to receive the content. I would reach 1 out of 50 people, and out of 5 people 1/10 of a person. That is the way it is, and one must expect it. What cannot take place through teaching occurs by selection. Human beings in whom you have called forth a resonance will come together. This selection is what we must seek today. Then we will make progress. A certain resignation is necessary in order not to live out of the feeling of power that leads us to want to teach, to convince the others. We must absolutely have this resignation. That people so often do not have this is connected precisely with, I am speaking of those practicing religion, their theological educational background. This theological training is based fundamentally on the idea that we can teach everyone, and on the idea that we should not resort to selection. For this reason, we must find the ways and means of taking up from the theological training, above all, a feeling relationship to spiritual content, to the content of the spiritual world. You see, theology has also reached the point of placing knowledge of God higher than life in God, than the experience of the divine in the soul. This experiencing the divine within the soul is what gives us the power to have an effect upon the simplest, most unspoiled person. This experience of the divine within must actually be schooled. Modernity has worked against this. The more people strive to find abstract concepts for something that exists supersensibly, the more they work against the experience of the divine within, and the less they take supersensible existence itself into their soul. We really need a living preparation and training for theological knowledge. Here something esoteric enters in. A law must be pointed out. First of all, as I mentioned before, when you want to teach someone something, you must not, as a sensible person, merely contemplate how you should bring a picture or some content. Naturally, you must do this to the fullest extent, but you must also always know more than you say. I do not mean this in a bad sense at all. If you proceed from the standpoint of the modern professors, which is that you should appropriate for yourself only what you will communicate to the others, you will not achieve much with religious communications. You must have, when you speak about the Bible, for example, your own individual content in which you live, in addition to the esoteric content. The exoteric is nothing other than the expressed esoteric. There is no absolute boundary between exoteric and esoteric. The one flows seamlessly into the other. The esoteric content becomes exoteric when you express it. Basically, the effectiveness of the Catholic priest is due to this practice of living in a content that is more or beyond what he speaks. This is what praying the breviary consists of. The priest seeks, through praying the breviary, to draw near to the divine in a manner that goes beyond that of the layperson. And the special content of the breviary, which goes beyond what one teaches, gives the priest at the same time the power to work effectively in the sermon and in other things. It is always interesting that Protestant ministers, who have served already a long time, come to me, it has happened quite often, and have said that they want something that is similar to the Catholic breviary. Please do not misunderstand me. I am not supporting Catholicism, least of all Roman Catholicism. There are long-time pastors who have come to me and have asked, why is it that we cannot reach the souls the way the Catholic priests, who of course misuse this ability, do? This is due, essentially, to the fact that the Catholic priests seek an esoteric relationship to the spiritual world. This is actually also what we are striving for in the endeavor to create a threefold social organism. Spiritual life, as we have it generally in common today, we are not speaking of the other spiritual life, is not a real spiritual life, but merely an intellectual life. People speak about the spirit. They have concepts, but concepts are not the living spirit. We must not have the spirit somehow merely in the form of concepts that sit in our heads. Rather, we must bring the spirit down onto earth. The spirit must be brought into our institutions. The spirit must hold sway in what weaves and works between human beings. We can achieve this only if we have an independent spiritual life in which we do not work merely out of concepts of the spirit, but where we work out of the spirit itself. Now the church has long endeavored to retain this living spirit. The schools lost it long ago. But we must bring the spirit back into the schools and the rest of our institutions. The state cannot bring the spirit. Only what is activity of the individual priest, and is at the same time community activity, can bring the spirit in. The work of the priest must be such that the priest has above all a conscious connection with the spiritual world itself, and not just concepts about the spiritual world. And then we come, naturally, to the issue of selection, of the assessing of the qualities of the priest. Now, this judging of the qualities of a priest can be very easily misunderstood. First, more people have these qualities than is thought. They are just not developed or nurtured in the right way. Second, the selection is often a question of destiny. When we come to have a living spiritual life and the questions of destiny become enlivened again, priests will take their place more out of the community of human beings than out of self-examination, which bears a strongly egotistical character. It is indeed true that we must appropriate a certain sense for what demands objectively that we do this or that. Perhaps I might be allowed to relate an example that I have used in various places. I gave a lecture in Colmar on the title Bible and Wisdom. Afterward, two Catholic priests came to me. You can imagine that Catholic priests have read none of my work, as it is forbidden for them to do so. And it is basically considered an anomaly when Catholic priests attend an anthroposophical lecture. However, they were also probably harmless. They approached me guilelessly, as I had said nothing in the lecture that would have been repugnant to them. They said, "Actually, we cannot say anything against what you said. We, too, have purgatory, and also refer to a supra-sensible life after purgatory." Now, precisely in this instance, I had deemed it to be good to hold two lectures, titled The Bible and Wisdom, 1 and 2. In the first lecture, I said nothing about reincarnation. Thus, they did not notice anything that contradicted the Roman Catholic view. Therefore, they had nothing against what I had said. But the how was another thing. They felt they could not agree with this how. Their way was the right way, one, because they spoke to and for everyone, whereas I spoke for only a few prepared people, to people who already had a certain preparation. Then, after some back and forth between us, I said, "You see, it does not matter whether you or I are convinced that we speak to and for everyone. This conviction is understandable. We would perhaps not speak at all if we were not convinced that we formulate things and permeate what we bring with such substance that we are speaking for all human beings. It does not matter that we have the conviction that we speak for and to everyone, But what is important is whether everyone comes to you in the church. And so, I ask you, does everyone come to you in the church when you speak? Of course, the priests could not say that everyone came. They had to admit that many do not. That is the objective fact. I have spoken for those who do not go to you, and yet who seek a path to Christ. The facts of the situation show us what task we have. I wanted only to show a way in which we should accustom ourselves to allowing our personal tasks to be determined by destiny and objectivity. I wanted to show that we should not, as in the case in the world today, brood over our own personage, which basically is there only to fill the place which the divine cosmic powers have given to us, but we should attempt to observe signs out of which we can recognize where we should be placed. We can do this. Again and again people come with the following soul question. What corresponds to my specific abilities? Or, how can I bring my abilities to bear in the world? This question is much, much less important than looking around ourselves objectively to see what needs to be done. When we get involved with what we notice there, we will see that we have many more abilities than we think. These abilities are not so very specific. As human beings, we can do an extraordinary amount. We have quite universal soul qualities, but not so many specific ones. This brooding over our own selves and believing too strongly that we each have our specific abilities or talents that should be cultivated is basically a very subtle egotism. Those who wish to attain the qualities that we are talking about here must overcome this subtle egotism. Now, I believe I have said from my side how I understand the issues. We can contemplate these things between now and tomorrow. If it is all right with you, I would like to recommend that we meet again at 11 a.m., and I ask you not to hold anything back. We want to deal as fully as possible with whatever you have on your mind. The end of Lecture 1.